Hey guys, it's me, Tim.
And me, Camille.
And today's show fulfills a promise of sorts we made to you a few weeks ago.
We told you guys we were working on something about the near daily protests here in St. Louis. Shut it down!
Now, there are many reasons people have been pouring into the streets, but one of the biggest is police accountability.
Or rather, frustration about the lack of police accountability.
The catalyst for all this is the 2011 shooting death of a black man named Anthony Lamar Smith, and the court case of Jason Stockley, a white former St. Louis police officer who pulled the trigger.
Stockley was caught on tape saying he was going to kill Smith and was accused of planting a gun, among other things. He went to trial earlier this summer, but a local judge declared him innocent in mid-September.
Demonstrations in streets, in parks, and at businesses have followed. So have allegations of excessive use of force used against protesters by police officers, who at last count have arrested more than 300 people.
In the course of these arrests, police have been accused of trapping, macing, and tasing protesters, and even beating a black undercover police officer.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
Yet, there was a particular moment early on that really highlighted just how fraught and tenuous the relationship between law enforcement and a community can be. During one late-night protest, as they were clearing the streets, police here marched and chanted, "Whose streets? Our streets."
The sound isn't great, but here's a quick video clip that went viral of police making that chant.
All right, guys.
Yeah, it almost seemed like a taunt from a bunch of mostly white guys in uniforms with weapons.
And I know that for many people, this moment was extraordinary.
Certainly for James Buchanan. He watched footage on TV and says he was appalled.
It's very unfortunate.
Buchanan is 74 and retired, but for most of his life, he was a police officer for more than 20 years in St. Louis.
In a couple of years at the end of his career, he spent as a chief of police in a small suburb just outside the city limits.
We have an attitude among our police that feel that when people are exercising their First Amendment rights legally, that they're chanting that they own the streets, which is kind of a offhand way of saying is that the police are the ones who will determine who, what, when, and where we decide to extend to those the right to protest.
Protecting that right, Buchanan says, isn't just about protesters.
Because undergirding this is the whole question of what America is going to become. Are we going to slip into a state of fascism? Or are we going to uphold the principles by which this country was founded on?
And Buchanan says while the sound and image of officers saying they own the streets is startling, it's also representative of a decades-long fight.
A fight to change the way those with the most authority in this country, police, treat people often with the least, black people.
It's been a continual fight.
In many ways, the recent protests here in St. Louis are a reminder of a national wave of outside efforts to change policing and the criminal justice system. But in today's episode, we're coming at it from a different perspective.
We're zooming in on the enduring quest of black officers in St. Louis who've been trying for decades to change the system from the inside.
From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here, a show for people somewhere on the woke spectrum.
It doesn't really take too much thought to figure out why we have such a huge and historical problem in this country between police and the black community.
But Buchanan, the retired police chief, recited for us a pretty good summation.
It comes from a professor named Robert F. Wintersmith, who wrote his thesis about police and the black community in 1973.
Systematic invisibility coupled with the historical and contemporary police behavior in the black community, characterized by frequent charges of brutality and harassment have served as the very concrete, identifiable symbol of the system. The police institution is the agent for and the guardian of the existing societal arrangements. That's pretty powerful. That says it all, that when we couldn't sit at a lunch counter, if we were in the wrong place, the police were called to remove us. If we were didn't sit in the back of the bus, Rosa Parks was arrested because she took the wrong seat. And so anything that this society deems that's inappropriate, the police are called to enforce it. So here we have an institution that's supposed to be serving and protecting, but the societal arrangement is diametrically opposed to the very mission of the police.
Buchanan read this passage while we were all gathered at a pretty important place in St. Louis's law enforcement history.
We're standing at the location of the former 9th District Police Station at the corner of Leffingwell and Samuel Shepherd Drive, which was formerly Lucas Avenue.
So there's nothing here right now, what we're looking at, but they're saying this used to be a police station.
As a matter of fact, it was one of the most exclusive police stations in the city of St. Louis because we had just to the east of us downtown, and of course was at the time developing, was the Locust Business District, as you can see, perhaps maybe one of the remnants of the signs that are still here, and also the Grand Center, which was the Fox, the Symphony.
Buchanan worked at this station in 1974 and 1975.
But I've also worked all over the city. I worked in the 3rd District, the 4th District, the 5th District, the 7th District, 8th District, and the 9th District. So, and in personnel, yeah. So I was all over the department.
The 9th District station also was significant, though, because it was the genesis of two police organizations in St. Louis.
It was the birth of the St. Louis Police Officers Association, and it was the result of the birth of the St. Louis Ethical Police Society.
That's right. Here in St. Louis, there are two police unions. The Police Officers Association is like most typical collective bargaining units.
And the Ethical Society of Police is specifically geared toward addressing the needs of black officers.
Both organizations were founded during the Civil Rights era, and their beginnings are entangled, of course, in race. The story goes like this.
In 1968, an Illinois man, the Reverend Charles Cohen, formed a civil rights organization here in St. Louis. It was called the Black Liberators. And one day, Cohen and another man were brought to the 9th District Station. There was an altercation, and the Liberators were severely beaten.
They were accused of resisting arrest, assaulting a police officer, which obviously they both denied. But after the incident, there was an investigation by the police department, and they did find that there had been some excessive force used with handling these two particular suspects. And as a result, the police officers in the city of St. Louis, mostly the white officers, felt that the Board of Police Commissioners or the police department had actually sided with this militant group, and they decided to organize as a result of it.
This was an encouraging development for Buchanan and other black officers on the force because they had some concerns of their own, and the union sounded like a good idea.
But our union needs to address the issues specifically confronting the black community, the credibility of the police service, police brutality, the excessive use of force, the discrimination that black officers experience being police officers, and then the discrimination that was conducted actually in the process of becoming a police officer.
In 1972, the black officers got official permission to form the Ethical Society of Police. They called themselves the Conscience of the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department.
By then, Buchanan had been on the force for about 7 years, and his choice to poke and prod at the system, it had real cost. He takes us someplace else to explain that.
So here we are, destination number two.
Destination number two. This is the Lynch Street, former 3rd District Police Station.
Well, now it's a barbecue station.
No,
yeah, it probably smells better than it did maybe back then.
Yeah, I think it does a little bit better.
Back then, most of the neighborhood stations looked the same. Squats, brick buildings with some really cool Art Deco signs.
They're really pretty, actually.
Mm-hmm,
yeah. The one that we're at, though, is at the corner of Lynch and 12th Street, sandwiched in between a highway and the Anheuser-Busch plant in South St. Louis.
So when Buchanan got here, he was one of the first black police officers to work at this station.
It wasn't by choice.
I was sent to the 3rd District Police Station as punishment, actually.
Remember, this was just a few years after Buchanan and the other black police officers had begun to organize and demand better treatment for themselves and the black community.
And many in the majority white police departments were not on board with that idea.
There was a lot of resentment for my presence being there. And I was told when I got here that basically don't look for any help if I need to have some assistance, and nobody was coming to help me.
Okay, we just need to note that in law enforcement, this idea of backing each other up, it's a big deal.
And there was a lady that owned, she was quite prominent in politics in this area. Her name was Miss Watson. She owned the Watson Funeral Home. And her son and herself got together, Miss Watson, and they actually formed a citizens patrol assistance for James Buchanan.
This was back in the day when it was relatively easy to get your hands on a police radio and listen in to just about any call you wanted.
Good old days.
They knew my call letters, and actually, if I received a call and it was a call where they figured I needed assistance, they would come and stand by me and watch me, and that went on for almost 2 years.
Buchanan credits this citizen shadow with keeping him alive in those first couple years in the 3rd District. Others eventually took notice, too.
And it kind of sort of embarrassed many of the officers that were here and in the 3rd District, and they actually later on decided that they would give me help.
Still, though, Buchanan says there were many instances where he was basically told, stay in your place.
One time, Buchanan was on patrol when he noticed a bunch of trash in the street. He stopped, started to pick papers up, and realized that what looked like debris was actually secret government documents that had blown out of a nearby incinerator.
It happened to be the top secret firing system for the F-14 jet. And so I picked this particular document up, and I realized what it was. I contacted my supervisor. The supervisor immediately contacted the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Federal Bureau of Investigation came through. They contacted Air Force Intelligence. We had maybe 50 to 75 federal officials gathering up this information.
After all the documents had been gathered up, Buchanan was hauled into his supervisor's office.
He told me to take off my gear and pull out my pockets to see if I had retain anything from the top secret documents. And I says, Captain, are you serious? I said, if I had wanted to take something, surely I would have done it before I notified you. But it was really to insult me and to demean me in a way that was to make me feel less than being significant under these circumstances.
Buchanan says back then, it wasn't uncommon for black officers to face false accusations about how they did their jobs. He tells us of a time he encountered a woman in the police station.
The woman, who was black, claimed she'd been punched by a white officer during a traffic stop. Buchanan demanded help for the woman, who was eventually taken to the hospital.
And apparently she did have some type of internal injuries that was causing her bleeding. And she alleged that during the course of this arrest, that this particular officer that made the arrest took her wedding ring off. And when they did the investigation, I was charged with stealing the lady's ring. I never touched her. I never had any contact with her. But I was actually charged. Through the investigation, I was exonerated. But the interesting thing was that they gave me a kind of a disposition that it remained on my record for the entire duration of the police department.
Buchanan got into law enforcement to right wrongs, and it was a childhood experience that first gave him a glimpse that one of the biggest wrongs was police attitudes toward people who look like him.
It happened one Sunday morning when the Buchanans were on their way home from church in the family car, a 1950s Buick Roadmaster. Buchanan was 11.
And there was a ice cream store, which was called Reed's Ice Cream. And we were saying, Dad, would you stop and get us some ice cream? And he said, okay, kids, settle down. And in the course of traveling east on Page, there was this church stop sign at Euclid Avenue. And what the churches would do at that particular time, they had these church stop signs, and the deacons would come and turn the signs, and when church service was over, they would turn them back so that, you know, they would be facing the church itself. And the sign appeared to be turned, but it was partially sticking out slightly toward the street. And my dad said he just assumed because it had been turned that they just hadn't turned it completely, and he went through it. And this police officer stopped him and said that he ran the stop sign. So when he came up to the car, he said, "Nigger, didn't you see that stop sign?" And my dad said, "Well, officer, if you don't respect me, would you please respect my wife and my children?" And he said, "Nigger, I said, didn't you see that stop sign?" And so at this, my dad got out of the car. And so the officer drew his gun and he said, "Get your black ass back in the car." And so my mother was sitting on the front seat and she jumped out of the car and stepped in between the officer and my dad and said, "Jimmy, please get back in the car." And the officer's revolver at this time was pointed at my mother's breast. And we were horrified because I could envision not only my father getting shot, but my mother getting shot. And so I guess my dad, realizing the seriousness of the situation and the fact that now my mother was drawn into it, he got back into the car.
The police officer called for backup. Officers searched Buchanan's father, accusing him of drug possession after finding some aspirin he took for high blood pressure. And then they took him to jail.
Testing later confirmed the pills were just medicine, and Buchanan's father was released. But the incident left a lasting impression.
I could not believe that the people that I had been told to respect and honor had this kind of disdain for me as a black citizen. So I said, "I'm going to become a police officer and hopefully do something to change this kind of environment."
Buchanan's family was disappointed. They'd wanted him to go into medicine or law.
They really felt becoming a police officer was beneath the expectations that they had for me as their only son. But after I became a police officer and those things that I tried to champion as an officer, they were quite proud of me, and they said the things that I did really exceeded what I could have done as a lawyer and as a doctor.
In fact, in the early years of the Ethical Society, meetings were held in Buchanan's mother's living room. And not long after getting that official organization status, the group did something that would probably seem radical even today. They protested in uniform.
But it was about 1973, I believe.
The seeds of their protests were planted during the Ethical Society's push for the department to hire more black police officers. But top brass told the group there weren't any qualified candidates. Black recruits, the administration said, could only read at an eighth grade level.
This was totally ridiculous because the first black officer that was promoted in the St. Louis Police Department was a man by the name of Ira Cooper. Ira Cooper, during the early 1930s and late 1920s, came into the police department with two master's degrees.
The black officers demanded officials retract their statements and threatened to demonstrate in front of headquarters.
We were told that if we came out in numbers, that the chief had already notified the National Guard and that the National Guard would be there to disarm us and relieve us of our commissions as police officers. And we had 145 African-American police officers demonstrate in uniform in front of headquarters.
Not one officer was arrested.
But Buchanan faced the consequences again.
Chief Camp called me into his office. He said, "Well, Jim, we both reached as high as we're going to ever go." He said, "I can't go any higher because I'm the chief of police, and you'll never go any higher because you just messed up your career." He was right. I retired as a sergeant, but it was worth every bit of it because I always say the sacrifice that the ancestors made was much greater than my sacrifice in terms of a possible promotion further than sergeant in the St. Louis Police Department.
Coming up, we follow the thread Buchanan started to unravel 4 decades ago.
And we tell you about the ways a new group of black police officers are trying to make change now.
More than 4 decades have passed since James Buchanan helped form the Ethical Society for Police. And these days, most black police officers are members of both unions.
And we wanted to get the St. Louis Police Officers Association take on black officers' long fight to change the department from within. Here's who they connected us with.
Hi, my name is Sergeant Charles Lowe from the St. Louis City Police Department.
Lowe met up with us at a downtown restaurant, and he spent 19 years on the force.
Not only am I a district rep for the police association, but I'm also the chairman of the Minority Diversity Committee.
3 years ago, Lowe was ambushed while sitting in his patrol car in the city's upscale Central West End neighborhood. He was working an extra job providing security, and a bulletproof vest saved his life. Lowe says the shooting left him in bad shape, both physically and emotionally, and he credits his fellow officers, black and white, with helping him pull through.
He's since gone on to found a nonprofit called Project Hurt. It provides extra services to officers who've been wounded in the line of duty. Behind the blue line, he says there isn't much tension between the Ethical Society of Police and the Police Officers Association.
Being conscious of diversity in our department, that's equal on both sides of the wall.
When it comes to how recent protests in the city have been handled by the police department, Lowe said he sees it from both sides. Here's what he told us when we asked him about that moment when police chanted, "Whose streets, our streets."
I only talked to a couple officers, and everyone said that they were, I guess, just trying to get, I didn't say motivated, but trying to get upbeat about, hey, we got to do this. Let's bring calm back to our city. Because at that point, windows were getting broken off, from what I understand. Not only business windows, but cars were getting broken into, stuff like that. So they're trying to bring calm to a situation. I think the adrenaline of that got the officers like, "Oh my God, what do we do?" And they started chanting. I think that's what happened.
But how do you feel about it?
I'm indifferent about it. I've been in resistance where with someone, I've been shot at, heck, even. So often your adrenaline gets to you and you never know how you're going to react to it. So without me being there, I can't say I'm indifferent about it. It was the emotion they felt at the time, and they ran with that emotion. Was the chant possibly inappropriate at that time? And I could see how people could see they could be offended by that, if that was your question. But we're human. There were emotions on both sides of the table. Looking back on it, from what I would say of officers, they probably wouldn't do it again. And I wouldn't expect them to, you know. I think they were just trying to make sense of a chaotic situation.
But for other black officers, this chant symbolized much larger problems within the police department.
We work for people. We work for the people. So it's their streets.
This is Heather Taylor, the current president of the Ethical Society of Police. She's held the post for the past 3 years.
We work for the people. And when we lose sight of that, that's exactly what you get. You got people that think that they can chant that and that it's okay.
And while she too acknowledges that 12-hour shifts in tense situations have been hard on officers and their families, Taylor says that's no excuse.
It was just it wasn't called for. It was antagonistic, and we're in a position as officers to arrest someone, to take away their freedom, and sometimes to take away their life under the oath, the sworn oath of our job, which is based off of integrity and doing things the right way.
It's an oath that's at the core of Taylor's life, and her path toward taking it started early on.
You could just do so much in your community with helping, and, you know, some of the things later in life that kind of pushed me to becoming one were kind of negative encounters with the police and wanting to change them. And I've been assigned, I worked undercover for years. I've been assigned to child abuse, sex crimes, juvenile, worked in patrol as a sergeant, which was one of the best jobs I've ever had. I'll probably try to go back to patrol before I leave the department. But
why'd you like it so much? What was so great about being?
Man, it's patrol is like, it's like the best job you could have in uniform. You're out there, you see people, you get to drive around, you get to, you know, see kids, you get to stop in my police car. You know, I get to stop and just do things that I like doing.
But for the past 5 years, Taylor has worked as a homicide detective on the night shift. And at first, she thought she'd be a long shot to get the assignment.
Never had an African-American female sergeant there. So I was like, oh, I won't get it. And I talked to someone about it. It's like, hey, put in for it. Why wouldn't you get it? You know, you have the qualifications for it. Put in for it. Put in for it. And, I think because of my relationship, which most people probably didn't know at the time, with some of the POA guys, you know, white guys, they're white, old, some of them are grumpy that are assigned to me, and I got along with them, because what it was that I had a level of respect with them, because I didn't bite my tongue. I would tell them things how it's just exactly how I felt, whether you liked it or not, but I was always fair. You had to have the right fit, because those guys were set in their ways, and the way they do things, and they needed to have someone there that they respected. I had someone say to me the other day, Heather, aren't you, you know, you really have achieved a lot on this department. You're the first sergeant, female sergeant, an African-American sergeant female that's assigned to homicide. Am I supposed to pat myself on the back for that? That's not something I want to pat myself on the back. You're talking about 70 years of a history of a police department, and I'm the first African-American female sergeant that you thought was qualified enough to be assigned to homicide. That's not something you can, that's not something to celebrate. You know, those are the things when you're inside of this department and you look at the promotions, just the lack of diversity there with African-Americans. We know that. Transfers. I have officers that I have to tell to put in for a job. You will never get the job unless you apply for it. But the mindset of so many of our minority officers is that I don't know anyone. They're not going to give me the job.
Last year, the Ethical Society of Police released a 112-page report that lays out in painstaking detail how race has shaped the way the police department goes about its business.
The report is broadly composed of three parts: how the department views and fights crime in the city,
differences in how the department disciplines white and non-white officers,
and a pattern of hiring and promotion that elevates white officers over similarly qualified non-white officers.
I have officers that I have to tell to put in for a job. You will never get the job unless you apply for it. But the mindset of so many of our minority officers is that I don't know anyone. They're not going to give me the job.
The report notes that highly coveted specialized units are overwhelmingly white. For example, according to the report, in February 2016, the unit that investigates the department's use of force was entirely white.
This is especially problematic because these specialized units often serve as a springboard for advancing up the chain of command. And as a result, having so few people of color in these positions makes diversifying the command structure that much harder.
For years, the Ethical Society of Police ran a minority recruitment and mentoring program. And by last year, Taylor says, they started to see good results.
We're at 34% African-American at the time. 37 candidates hired in a year and a half time to become recruits and training police officers in the police academy. What happens after that program ends? They stop it. So we were at 34% African-American July of 2016. As it stands right now, we're at 30% African-American.
A
And do you anticipate that's just going to keep ticking down?
It's going to continue to decrease.
The struggle to diversify the police force isn't just about the best interests of black and brown officers.
Because she says having an overwhelmingly white department and command structure creates blind spots,
further straining its relationship with the public and leaving everyone less safe.
It's not because all white males are bad officers or terrible people. Not that at all. We have some great officers who are white males. However, most people feel comfortable with people who are most like them. You have that instant level of a connection culturally that's present there. So if we don't put an emphasis on cultural diversity, implicit biases, we're going to continue to have problems going forward.
Taylor has often been a vocal critic of how the police department here operates and how the law is generally enforced in St. Louis. And like James Buchanan decades earlier, she's faced the consequences.
She was disciplined last year for talking to a newspaper columnist about the department losing its high-tech gunshot detection system for 3 months because it didn't pay its bills.
And in September, Taylor made national headlines when she joined Reddit Hudson, the co-founder of the National Coalition of Law Enforcement Officers for Justice, in a video.
It was shortly before the verdict in the case of Jason Stockley. Now, if you remember, Stockley was the white police officer in the city of St. Louis who fatally shot Anthony Lamar Smith, a black man, in 2011. And Stockley's acquittal has sparked weeks of protests in St. Louis.
But before the judge's decision came out, Taylor said this in a video.
So collectively as a board, we came to the decision that we need to support a conviction of Jason Stockley for murder. And that's why we're here.
In the video, Taylor and Hudson lay out what they find troubling in the evidence. Here are some of the points they listed. Only Stockley's DNA is on the gun he says Anthony Lamar Smith pointed at him.
Stockley took off his gloves when handling evidence, and his partner allegedly shouted gun, yet kept his pistol holstered.
Soon after issuing this video statement, Taylor faced some serious backlash from some former and current officers on social media.
The former officer said he'd hoped that I was never in need of aid. Meaning if, yeah, that I was ever in, and we had one officer who liked the comment, that's a current officer. We had other officers who referred to me as some choice words, and, you know, one officer's family said that she hopes that I bleed out. But I do know, the good thing for me is that I do know that in the street, people from the community and officers would be there for me, ultimately. Not those officers.
It's interesting because James Buchanan said the same thing. He actually told us the story about how when he was in the 3rd District and he was told that or got mm-hmm. rumor of that, you know, mm-hmm. don't expect aid if you get in trouble, that it was community members who got a scanner and listened in. Mm-hmm. And they would come and kind of bear, you know, sort of protect him in different situations.
Yeah, I had, after that came out, you know, I filed an EEOC on those officers. You know, I believe in accountability starts with each officer. So when something happens and I know about it, mm-hmm. I file a complaint. You know, I don't back down from it because that goes against black officers as well. If we're doing wrong, we're useless to our community. 3 years ago, I was probably 40 pounds lighter. I had hair to my shoulder. My husband probably was happier with less stress, you know, worrying about what's happening with me, what they're going to do to me internally, my safety. My husband is, you know, more paranoid than me, you know, with the safety thing. Hey, we got to have cameras everywhere, you know, outside, camera in your car, you know, and it's difficult personally. The mental toll can be rough. Some days I'm like, man, I don't want to do this anymore. You know, if I could leave today, I probably would walk out of the door. You know, some days that's how I feel because of the things that are going on internally, the things that your community tells you about our police officers and some of them, how they're behaving, and you're fighting for people. And sometimes you feel like you're not making the moves as fast as you want them. You know, you get victories here, then you fall back. You know, it's just the mentality that exists within our police department, that culture, that thought process that has to change.
Back in the neighborhood he patrolled decades ago, James Buchanan says the need for the ethical society won't be going away anytime soon.
History will tell us it's going to take both. It's going to take the push from the outside and the push from the inside. And the only progress that we've ever made has been both. Dr. King said that progress is never a straightforward phenomenon. It's a cyclic phenomenon, which you have periods of regression and you have periods of progression. But let me just tell you something, the reason why I'm very encouraged. When I looked at that protest that you're talking about, when the police said that they own the streets, I saw so many young white people in those protests holding the signs that said Black Lives Matter. Now, what is that telling me? That's telling me that through all the forces of propaganda of segregation, all the propagation of the forces of racism, that there are white people with a genuine sense of fair play, a genuine sense of righteousness, that believe that the kind of efforts to maintain a system that discriminates is unrighteous and unfair. And they're participating in making those changes.
So there is, of course, a lot more to this story and a lot to what's going on here right now in St. Louis. And we can't cover it all, but there are a ton of journalists right now who are doing a really good job. And we encourage you guys to go find it, whether it's on our website or our station's website, stlpublicradio.org. The local newspaper here has been doing a great job, but there's a lot of great journalism happening around what's happening here in the wake of the Stockley verdict.
We Live Here is produced by me, Tim Lloyd.
And me, Camille Stanley.
Shula Newman is the executive editor of St. Louis Public Radio.
And from St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.